It is a good story.
You see, and the thing is, the reason that Elizabeth May did the meeting that night, and she apologized profusely for it, was that there was some, scheduling reason that forced her to do it that night. She said, I would have preferred to do it, another night, not on American election night, but it just so happened I had to do it this night. So anyway, okay, then you're asking about Trump and my feelings about Trump. I mean, he's a confusing president. And silly. There's lots of silly things going on. His positions are I was watching Crosstalk, or I was watching Russia Today, and they brought up something, and I thought they really hit the nail on the head with this. Emmanuel Macron, this Napoleonic French guy, he made this awful speech at the 100th commemoration of the end of the World War One, and made this really insipid speech about nationalism, and saying it's different than patriotism, which they were saying it's just totally asinine. The words mean the same thing, the etymology of the words, it's all the same thing. And he's trying to draw some strange distinction between the two of them, and it's just ridiculous. But prior to this, evidently, Macron had said, we're going to have... he was presenting the idea that because of their relations with the United States or something or whatever, that they're going to have a European army.
Yes.
And Trump takes umbrage with this. But, the strange thing about Trump taking umbrage with this is that his whole presentation is that America is paying too much to protect other people, and that they should take more responsibility from monetary point of view and of building up their own militaries. Yet, the moment Macron says, oh, we're going to have our own military, he goes, oh, no, you don't. these kind of strange contradictions that go on, and the contradiction with the Saudis. He's saying the Saudis are great, they're wonderful, they're terrific, and all of that. I mean, this is more understandable, I guess. It's still silly, but. He goes, they're wonderful, they're great, they're terrific, and everything. And it's these Iranians are the great, they're the ones involved in terrorism and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, it's quite well known through WikiLeaks that even Hillary Clinton and all this going on in the Obama White House or whatever, they were saying that the Saudis were doing, they were the leading people hiring terrorists all over the world. I mean, it's in their own words they're saying that. So Trump is somehow ignoring that. Not that the Democratic Party would have done anything any different than Trump would with the Saudis, other than saying that they're great. Then he says Iran is this great terrorist thing, and then this Mohammed bin Salman, who they dub MBS, they give him an acronym so they don't have to say his whole name; it's too much work. He's involved in murdering this guy who lived in America, who was who no one talks about being like Khashoggi,
the evil May Brussels guy, Khashoggi.
Adnan Khashoggi. That's his uncle. Yeah. Adnan Khashoggi was this guy's uncle.
Yeah. So
these were elite people, pro-Saudi people, that somehow this guy had only recently become a critic of the Saudi regime. They make out like he was always, a critic of the Saudis. Far from it. I mean, he was, up until a year ago, he was promoting the Saudi regime. And there's other things about this Khashoggi guy that are suspect. But anyway, so they go in and the The Saudis are so emboldened that they do this outrageous attack on this guy, you know, murder him in their own embassy in another country, and use chainsaws to cut him up or whatever, and then Trump is involved in saying no, it's these Iranians that are involved in this, all this terrorism. It's all so silly.
People can't believe that he's so nuts. On the surface level, he just appears nuts.
Well,
the
thing is that you with the Saudis, it's more understandable that you would be saying one thing and all these other murderous things would be going on, and you sort of turn a blind eye to it. You know, like Trump's going, well, I know this. I know it happened, but look at all the money they're going to spend. that's a little more understandable from his point of view, in that it's like, oh, well, that's all about the money anyway, isn't it, on the bottom line? Like, if there are a lot of jobs, who cares where that guy got chopped up in a bandage? But Trump isn't one of these guys who's always going along crowing about human rights. So everybody else is caught flat-footed. Trudeau's caught flat-footed. Theresa May's caught flat-footed. They're all caught flat-footed about what to do about Saudi Arabia, because they're the ones always going around crowing about human rights. So Trump isn't really doing that. He's not as duplicitous as that, I think.
He's not an old-fashioned hypocrite. He's a modern hallucinator.
Right. He's hypocritical. He's hypocritical, but it's not of the
it's
kind of hypocrisy that we're used
to. You could say silly areas. He's so blatantly hypocritical that nobody can believe anybody would be that stupid, so they wonder if he's doing something else. And the pro-Trump people, they love him. Because
here's the thing: in a news con, then we extend even further. We go to these news con, this news conference that Trump had, where he actually stands there for quite a length of time. Even states in the middle of it, he goes, "Look, I'll be here until it gets boring. You know, if it gets boring, we'll stop it. You know, or if you get bored with what we're doing, then we'll stop it. Okay, but I'm just going to keep going."
Yeah.
Like he shows that, like he's saying, like he goes back to the idea of stamina, right? I've got the stamina, right?
Yeah,
I can
yeah.
keep going here. I'll keep going, but I'm in charge, right? he's establishing that he's in charge, but. None of the people, I watched that whole thing. They don't ask a single interesting question.
That's
they
right.
don't bring up any type of, they don't go, well, you said this about that, and now this is going on. How do you square that? Nobody ever does that. They always go, they're always trying to infer he's a racist and all of that. That's their big thing. All identity politics stuff and nationalism and, like, basically they're saying, when they mention nationalism.
Uh-oh. You got disconnected? Did I get disconnected? Hey, Bill, am I still on?
Still on, Bobby.
Okay, so Greg got knocked off.
Yeah, Greg got knocked off.
What do we do? I guess I'll have to call him back. I'm going to play a little song here. Anyway, it's very interesting what Greg's talking about. I enjoy his perceptions of things. Let's see. I'll just go up and find the famous Big Jazz. Holly says, ah, poor Marie Le Pen. She would have been way better than Macaroni Man. Wait just a second. Okay, Greg, just try me on here. You're going to try to phone in again. Okay, I'll phone you. Okay, tell him I'll phone you.
Yeah, what often happens, Bobby, is that after a certain while, they just cut you off on the cell phone.
Yeah.
They did that. That's what they did to me earlier.
Right. Okay, let me just play something in the interval while I get them.
Yeah. Zappa, something Zappa.
No, I like this. It's my theme song.
Oh. Okay. Ah!
Good, Greg. Reiner, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was your you're on a roll there. What was your last words, Greg? What were you talking about?
I wish I could remember.
We just had Trump, and Trump was the press conference, and nobody asked a real question.
And nobody answers any, like, they're all silly, stupid questions. I mean, they're as silly as he is. And and
that's right.
You know, and I mean, I did admire what he did at the press conference. I support what he did about the, you know, like telling that Acosta to sit down. I think Trump was in charge, and to have a guy from the press getting up there and telling, you know, start talking about how he would run the world. I mean, I just think it's, or run the country at very least. I think it's well, he's silly.
Hey, Greg, that's the frequency change that Ian's talking about. He predicted this. The media, Trump, everybody's fucking nuts. And that's why a lot of people are afraid. Carolyn even said, I ain't going on Drudge Report anymore. It's too fucking nutty out there. Too ridiculous. It's just a big distraction. So, but this is what
we're
seeing.
You're not going on what?
What?
She's not going on what?
So Carolyn usually looks at Drudge to see the headlines, see what's going on.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And she said last week, I'm not doing it anymore because it's just too ridiculous what the headlines are. It's a distraction. It doesn't seem to satisfy her. So, but millions of people are doing that. They're not observing what's going on anymore because it doesn't make any sense. And you're right. The media are as nutty as Trump.
Yeah, because there's no the only common sense that I get from any media outlet that I see is on Russia Today.
Yeah.
That's the only one.
That's right,
like,
here.
It's the only one where there's sober conversation about what's going on, and it isn't just, you know, constantly either demeaning Trump or agreeing with him on everything.
Yeah.
There's some thought and analysis about what's going on, and you know, saying, well, you know, people either agree with one thing or other that he's doing or disagree with it, and it's not just across the board type of panning or of lauding of what's
right.
going on. And
Greg, listen to this, Greg.
Yeah.
The one point I saw that I like Trump, he looks at some reporter and she says something and he says, That is a really stupid question. Then he says, he keeps looking at her and says, you know, I've been watching you. You always ask stupid questions. Now, that's a very interesting interpersonal level that gets out of the wall of the president.
Well, and the other thing, the other thing that was interesting
you like
about
that?
It.
Did
what,
you like that incident? You know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I did like it. And the thing that I thought was very interesting about it was that I think I saw him say it in close-up. Then they went to the long shot,
yeah.
And the person that he's saying it to, I think, was a black
yeah.
woman.
Yeah.
And so Trump is, on the one hand, being accused of or being insinuated that he's a racist. And instead of going, uh-oh, I've got a black person up here who's going to ask a question. Maybe
he didn't block it. He just was genuine.
Yeah, he just says, okay, I think that's a stupid question. And of course he's just, I mean, and it was a stupid question, I think. And he just called it, and he doesn't care that it's a black woman. He doesn't,
yeah.
The gloves don't come off. And
right.
just because of this identity politics stuff. And one could say he's treating people as people and not
yeah.
as a race or a gender or something
and
like that.
And there's a live thing. It's like on CKLN or on the show here, we just deal with the voices. He deals with the voices. He's not looking at
yeah.
what they are in it. He just said, okay, that voice said, that's just what I say to that voice. Yeah, that's
well,
what
it,
people
it,
like about him.
Yeah, it's like when I was on CKLN, it became apparent at times that people thought that Daniel and I were both black.
Yeah.
Because we didn't take a position that suggested that we were, advocating for some kind of race or anything. I mean, it added into it that there were so many black types on there. Or even if people weren't black, they tried to pretend they were black. one of the people on there, her name was DJ Chocolate. I mean, wouldn't
yeah.
you think that someone named DJ Chocolate would be black? Well, she wasn't. She was Jewish, white Jewish. I thought that was pretty bad.
Okay, you got anything to say, Reiner, at this point about what we're saying?
I'm enjoying Greg's analysis so much. I've just been listening. I haven't really put any words together. I do find that the comments around Trump are interesting because I had to deal with it when I went back to work because I live in Canada and work in the U.S., right? So when I went back to school after the election, the crying in my office was unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how many people would come into my office, and if people were sick to their stomach, they were throwing up, they were going to the hospital, they were
because of Trump.
They were getting drunk. They were doing, it's just like
this is awesome.
And I'm just sitting there going, like, what is wrong with you people that you guys wanted to change?
Yeah,
and you got it.
Did you say they wanted a change? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, they wanted a change. They wanted the woman, right? They wanted the woman. They weren't going to give Bernie a chance. He was the only one that seemed to have any brains. And
right.
And so they weren't.
Well,
and he didn't because he was too
you
old.
You know,
they all said.
Your people in Canada. I'm on Paula Dude, where all your liberal Toronto art buddies are on there. And they were all celebrating this Muslim woman that came in, congresswoman, Muslim.
Yeah.
So I went to a guy that I can sort of find out what's going on, Dennis Michael Lynch on YouTube, and he's a journalist, and he's there, and he starts to show us that the place where she's from, the local Muslim gets to be a city hall guy, some position, and they swear they have their allegiance. They swear the guy in on the Torah or the Quran, the Muslim thing, the Muslim Bible, wow. Quran. And that's illegal. But nobody is objecting, and the white counselor of the institution comes in and lets him swear his allegiance to Allah. Allah, wow. Whatever you say it. And he's just showing that there are regions in the United States that are all Muslims now, and all the non-Muslims run and leave and go off somewhere else. And then he's quoting from the Muslim Brotherhood document or their belief that they will infiltrate America and take over. But this interesting point of they don't declare any allegiance to Allah, to God, and they will consider all matters in terms of Allah's doctrine.
Yeah.
That's what they swore in on. So that's pretty interesting phenomenon going on. So, you know, the yep. Toronto liberal idiots up there, they just celebrate, oh, isn't it nice that a Muslim lady got in there? Well, no, she's Muslim Brotherhood and she's a fucking terrorist.
You bring up something interesting here, Bob, that I've never really thought about. When I go, and if I've ever had to give sworn testimony in something, I'm given a choice. I can either do it on a Bible, or I can't remember what they call it to do it the other way, right off the top of my head. But
yeah.
Anyway, there's a way of doing it with the Bible or not a Bible. Now, is it possible that you can go to swear, and they'll say, well, you can do it on the Talmud or the Torah or the Quran or the, like, would they actually give that choice?
Well, the Dennis Lynch and them were saying, as white patriotic Americans, no, you can't do that. It's a country in the name of God. And everything, the dollar
right.
bill,
is there actually a law that says that when you're swearing, I mean, they've got themselves into another pickle here, haven't
yeah.
they, with
yeah.
this whole swearing on a Bible thing, where they just haven't said, look, this is a public institution and we're not going to have religious things get in the way. You just come and you swear to, not to God, but to the, like, instead they've given this little option open, and now you open up the possibility of people walking in and going, I'm not going to swear on that Bible. And I'm not gonna do it the other way either. I'm not gonna do it the secular way. I'm gonna do it on the religious document that I believe in. Dangerous precedent, huh? It's
yeah.
really bad.
So you're saying in Canada you're given an option, and we don't know what it is in the States.
Oh, I'm sure in America, it's very standard. They say you can swear on the Bible, or you can, you know, so help me God business, or you can do it on, I can't remember what they call it, where you do it without religious affiliation.
This is in the States or in Canada?
In Canada, I've done it. I've had to do it, you know, not very many times, but when I went to the CRTC, I think I had to swear.
Yeah.
I gave testimony and I had to swear. It was the CKLN one. I had to swear. I did the other ones where you don't have to swear. They made damn sure when I went to that CKLN one, because eventually they took away their license, that I had to swear.
Yeah.
I had to swear, you know, I had to give an oath. And I had a choice. A lot of people from CKLN did it on the Bible, though. Imagine that. Lots of them. I would say at least that the really diehard CKLN people, the ones who'd been there for years, they were all these, you know, sort of small, supposedly small L liberals or whatever.
Yeah.
Most of them swore on a Bible. Yeah, and the ones
well, how
that
about
were,
that liberal values come out of the Gutenberg Galaxy. So that's
mm-hmm.
the main book for the Gutenberg Galaxy. They don't know their literate bias.
Well, they're doing it. See, the reason a lot of them were doing it, a lot of the white people, even the white people that were giving themselves like black DJ names, the reason they were doing it was to be in as they saw it, in solidarity with black people, because black people would appear to be diehard Christians in America, at least.
Right.
Black people in America and Canada are, you know, deeply Christian, right? And or say they are or appear to be. And so they, I got the feeling that they were doing that, you know, because they thought, oh, these black people won't put up with me anymore
yeah.
if I don't do it on the Bible.
Right.
Because they'll think, so anyway, that was my impression of it. It was an interesting moment to see what they were going to do, you know, which different people that were getting up there to give testimony, what they would do in this situation, because you never see that anywhere outside of that. This is a quasi-judicial hearing. So, but I went to another one, and you didn't do it.
Okay,
you know,
so
I could have said anything. I couldn't lie there at that one because it was serious. It showed how serious they were about that.
Well, you
that
couldn't do
license.
What?
Well, I could go to, well, if I'm
no,
not
no,
swearing.
No, you had to do the Bible?
Well, not only that, but I mean, at the one where I have to do either the Bible or swear the other way, they're saying you can't lie, right? You're not allowed to lie. When you go to another hearing that's sort of similar in a way, run by the same quasi-judicial body, I didn't have to do it. They're basically saying, well, you can lie.
Okay.
But the CKLN one, no, you couldn't lie because this is serious. If we find that we've taken the license away based on you lying, we're going after you.
Yeah. Okay, so, Trump is unmeasurable, uncharitable, nothing's, yesterday was bad, today's great. What he won a couple of, the seats got decided in his favor. So now he's happy today, even though he's very unhappy, they said, a week ago. But if you read his tweet, and I've read every tweet by Trump since he got in. Okay?
Really?
Yeah, I've read every tweet. Carol and I reread his tweets, and they're ridiculous. It's always just, oh, some Boy Scouts came in. They were great. I love these Boy Scouts. You know, a lot of it is aimless. Like, the job of the president is just to receive groups and say how great they are.
Well, it is. It's a bit like being the mayor, isn't it? I mean, a lot of these sort of big, you know, like, I'm the mayor of Toronto. What do they do mainly? They just go out and, you know, cut ribbons and say things, and occasionally they have to be involved in something that appears to be serious and take some position or another and take responsibility, evidently, for a snowstorm.
So the cynical ones say that, you know, your mayor, John Tory, is it? His name?
John Tory.
Yeah.
Tory.
He's doing secret business deals. Ron Rosenbaum and all these New York critics, they're saying Trump's doing incredible business deals secretly with his kids and all that. That's the only reason they can understand why a guy like him would be in there, because his role just seems to be phatic and just to say how great everything is and just to greet people. And in this TV show, Designated Survivor, that Maggie Q is in, they show all Kiefer does is he brings someone in, he's polite to them, then they make a little agreement, and then he shakes them and says, hey, thanks for coming in. That's all the president does. Everybody else is doing the work preparing for the meeting, and then he just says, thank you, and that's that. So it's really a dumb role as it's presented on the TV show. But
I think it's
so
pretty
Trump,
accurate. I mean, how could it be? The thing is that it doesn't make sense, really, and Putin has brought this to people's attention. You know, like they try to, the media tries to make out that Putin is this incredible puppet master. All their enemies are incredible at doing amazing things, that, you know, being everywhere at every time, and they're almost
godly.
They're godlike, you know. They're able to do things. They're evil God, and Saddam Hussein was that way, right? He could do amazing things. Like he could conjure up uranium, at a moment's notice, you know, through underground tunnels or something coming all the way from Africa. Or, you know, like they didn't have to give any explanation about how he got all of these things that they claimed he had. He could just get them, and Putin is sort of in the same way. And when Putin has been accused of this, because it runs around so much that the media actually apparently believes that he can do this, when they actually confront him with this, he says, do you think I can do everything? He says, I leave things to other people to do, and they report to me. He says, my ambassador in London, he does his job there, and then he, if there's something that he thinks I need to know, he tells me. He says, but I'm not always in communication with him. He says, we have people all over the world. He says, I couldn't possibly keep in touch with every person in every embassy and be involved in everything that's going on. He says, it just doesn't make any sense. I just deal with things that are sent to me that they feel are important. And I trust these people to do that. And if there's nothing important, then they don't send it to me.
Okay, now Trump, great. McLuhan said in 72, the automated presidential surrogate, so he said he's talking about the president. He's not really a president. He's a surrogate for something else. There's someone else pulling strings, and he's automated, so he's a zombie. The automated presidential surrogate is a superlative nobody. Trump has come in and obsolesced McLuhan, and he's violating every one of those definitions. He's not a presidential surrogate. He is the president. He's not a superlative nobody, and he's hijacked it for personal agenda, not for impersonal robot fatted communion stuff. You know what I mean? He's actually created an interesting phenomenon in the White House by not being an automated presidential surrogate. At least that's
now, Bob, how old are you at this point? What is your age now?
In four years, Greg, I'll be 100. Just remember that.
Okay.
Let's go have a good birthday party.
I'm going to turn.
I might even invite you out here, Greg, to my birthday party. You know?
Actually, you know what? You know what? You know what? I'm applying for a passport, so I'll actually be able to do it.
All right.
So I'm planning a little trip next year. But anyway.
Well, that interview you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be interviewing me for the fucking documentary.
Well, that could happen. I'll bring over the cameras. The thing is that I'm going to turn 63 a month from today. Now, this is what I find about my life. And I don't know about you. You're a special person, I know. So let's...
Yeah,
I don't mean
to
compare.
Comparing
myself to you in any way is ridiculous. But
right. But
I'll just talk about the life of us normal people, all right?
Yeah.
What I feel are as normal people. I'm amazed at how little I get done in a day. And Trump's, what, 71, 72 years old?
Yeah.
I mean, it can only really do so much. I mean, a human being, unlike you, a human being can only do so much in a day. It isn't, they can only handle so many decisions and can only be involved in so much stuff.
Right.
And the projection of the U.S. president is somehow that, again, they're presented almost in a godlike fashion. But when you really think of it realistically, they can only do so much. And even, like, Trump actually, when he's getting on a plane and traveling from one location to another and doing these rallies, like several of them in a day, I mean, it is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you remember how he was doing that and Obama was doing that? And Obama, after, I don't know, a very short period of time, is hoarse and can barely speak. He's got, because he's, you know, Trump is evidently a teetotaler, doesn't smoke, has never drank, evidently.
Yeah.
I mean, and Obama, I mean, come on. I mean, this guy's probably doing everything. I mean, at least he's smoking, right? At very least. I mean, he has to chew Nicorette gum at a ceremony in France about World War II, you know, to get through it. I mean, he's a weak person from that standpoint. I mean, Trump is, for, you know, a man who's maybe what, maybe 20 years older than Obama or 15 to 20 years older than Obama. I mean, that's incredible. When he talked about having stamina compared to that, and Hillary Clinton had none, I mean, he wasn't kidding.
That's right.
I mean,
low energy Bush. Yeah, everybody's low energy compared to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, he actually appears to have an enormous amount of energy and stamina to go out and do what he did. I mean,
you know why, Greg? We know why.
Oh, really?
Yep.
He's on the orange drops. Okay. There
you go. Maybe other products since then.
Does it make your skin turn orange, though, Bob?
Make what?
Does it make your skin turn orange?
No, I don't know what that's about.
And do the RNA drops actually? Could it be the effects of the RNA drops that make him make hypocritical decisions?
Yes, he could be going from one world to the next, and he could be.
I was thinking, you know, last week I was listening to the show, to your show, and there were, you know, everybody was, you know, talking. Bert was on, and there was all this conversation. I went down to have a, you know, a little snack, and. And I thought, oh, and after, you know, I was sort of taking in all the things I'd heard during the hours that I was listening.
All the crazy stuff, yeah.
Yeah. well, and I thought, oh, I know another one of these things that the RNA, like another attribute of the RNA drops, makes one lack skepticism.
Yes, yeah, you feel so good. You believe everything.
You have absolutely no skepticism about anything.
That's right. That's right. We have no mental activity going on. We're just feeling good. Anything that happens.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure how to feel about that. I think I thought at first that's a really bad thing, and then I thought, well, then now that you're talking about it, I started thinking maybe just to accept any old information, anything, even if it doesn't make a blind bit of sense. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's a good space to be in. I don't know. Sort of makes you maybe less worry less.
Yes, yes. People, that's one of the main effects of the drops, is it makes you feel a little happier and a little less worry. That's the common effect of it. It's like Brave New World Soma. It could be considered a drug, you know.
Didn't Trump, speaking of that, at that news conference, he say, "Nothing worries me"? Didn't he say that?
He might have. I don't recall that particular.
Yeah, no, he says, nothing worries
me. He's showing
me.
Great ionic indifference to everything. You know, he's nothing, he says, nothing bothers me. He said something like, nothing gets under his skin. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, nothing bothers me. I'm not worried.
Yeah, I don't care what you guys say about me.
I mean, the thing is, you know, they can complain all they want about Trump and this and call him a Nazi and whatever they want. But, you know, all these crazy things that they want to say. I mean, these media are going and claiming he's a Nazi. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, they actually have a camp. Like, the whole place is filled with Nazis. Like, people, they're Nazis actually running the government. Like, actual Nazis. People who, and yet they're oblivious to that. They don't go, oh, what about these Nazis in Ukraine? They don't, and furthermore, they won't blame Trump for the, they blame Trump for the Nazis in America, but they won't blame them for the Nazis in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Nazis in Ukraine have gone to the United States and are recruiting or training other Nazis. And they don't talk about that because it goes against their whole agenda, right? Where they're all mad. I mean, they're not oblivious to what's going on. They just don't want. They're selective about the media.
Right.
They're selective.
Okay,
but,
great. Cabal took over in '63 after the Kennedy assassination. So that cabal had Rouge, Skolnick, May, Beter. They all say that. Somehow Trump has upset that cabal, and that cabal said to all the media, the Washington Post, the New York Times and everything, you fuckers just go after him day and 24/7. Just don't stop. It's like a real war. It's like Mr. Smith goes to Washington. And so the cabal has told the media just to be assholes for him because he, as Ian said, he beat the media. He embarrassed them. He embarrassed the cabal, who had groomed Hillary since her father opened up China. Remember, Hillary's father is the guy that behind the scenes knows that China owns America, and so he arranged for his daughter to be connected to Little Rock, Arkansas, because they were going to open up Walmart in the 70s to be the company that would take all the Chinese goods, because otherwise Nixon would have been given nothing. We never opened China to the world economy. China allowed America to continue in 71, 72, whenever that meeting happened. They said, okay.
Yeah, they really needed it.
What?
They really, America really needed that.
Well, Ian says they've been bankrupt since the 30s. So here's Hillary's father was the broker behind the scenes for that deal, and her father knew the real situation. So I said to Ian, so Hillary, as a kid, was destined to become in the White House in some form? And Ian said, yep. It was all pre-programmed. So the cabal thought she'd be in there, and then everything would be what it was supposed to be. And this guy really is causing a revolution, and people are really missing the major revolution, except the LaRouches. They see it. They see what Trump's doing. But I can't get anybody over there and anywhere else, especially on Paula Deuce's site, to even consider that. They basically banned LaRouche information from his forum. But But LaRouche is the most informed journalist. They're people. They know what's going on out there. That's how you find out things.
Do you know where I saw my first LaRouche article or LaRouche paper?
Where you did?
Yeah, where I saw, like, where I actually physically touched a LaRouche publication.
Well, would it be at an airport?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's
it. It was in Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah.
There was a big snowstorm there or something, and we were, I don't know, I think we were stuck there for a day or something, and I was in the airport, and there was a LaRouche publication on a seat in the waiting area.
Right. Well,
and that's where
newspaper?
I first... Yeah, a newspaper,
and
yeah.
And when was that? What, decade?
I would say that was about 19... either in the late 80s or, yeah.
Yeah, around
80s.
Then. Okay. Before you heard him on International Connection, or you did?
Well, I think I was aware. I think I'd already heard it.
Right. So I was there. I would occasionally visit the LaRouche organization. And one time at JFK or the other LaGuardia airport, I was flying back to Toronto, and that could have been 1984, 88. And so there was the LaRouche table. So I went up and started talking to them and told them all that me and Bob Marshall were doing with LaRouche and all that. And then I stood there with them at the table, and people were walking by, and some of them the Jewish people would spit on them or sort of make an insult. And I started arguing with these people that were ignoring LaRouche. And the LaRouches, they're called Nazis, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites and everything. They told me to fucking shut up. He said, we're not here to agitate people. We're reasonable, and if they don't like us, that's okay. So I realized that I couldn't be a CKLN hectoring in the actual holy office of LaRouche. I had to shut up.
So you're saying that at one time in America, maybe even today, that people could use airports as public spaces and distribute literature like the Hare Krishna and so on, right?
Yeah, and it got outlawed at some point in there in the early 90s. They kind of.
Right. So what I had probably seen was this was going on somewhere in a public space in the airport, and someone had picked up one of these publications, taken it into the lounge, and when they got on the plane, they just left it behind, and I picked it up when I was waiting myself.
But I was surprised that they weren't, they were very rational about how they present themselves. They were not going to, they respected people not liking them. And
yes, well, if you talked about, I think you were speaking earlier there about LaRouche claiming he was a Marxist, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's very similar to, I mean, I belong to a Marxist political party, as you know.
Yeah, you've been a terrorist every now and then.
Anyway, I was going to say something, but I won't.
There goes your passport, Greg.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to,
No, Greg, I'm just joking. Just joking. Greg's a nice, he's a Boy Scout.
And that's pretty, I would say generally that's the tack that we take as well when we encounter heckling.
Not, yeah.
No, I mean, I've seen, like if we meet a group of people, or when I say we, when we encounter a group of reactionary people, like organized group, then it gets a little more, there's a little more hectoring going on, you know. But when it's just when we're out there on our own and we're meeting the public, pretty much stay away from, you know, if they object to what we're saying, well, fine, you object to what we're saying. You know, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And we carry on.
And I'd never been in any political context, so I was just thinking, like, well, hey, this is interesting stuff. You should pay attention to it. Open your mind, you know. And I was out of context.
Yeah, in a way, they were being the marshals, right? They were being marshals of the situation, and you were getting out of line. And they could have viewed you as being someone who
an agitator
was trying to call. Yes, yes, they could have said, "Oh, this is someone sent by the state to give us a bad name."
And if you look in the history of LaRouche, a big thing the left says in 73, they said LaRouche groups were beating up communist groups in Baltimore and this place. And they forget that, no, how do you know who those people were? The FBI, they infiltrate a lot of these things.
Exactly.
You know, they aren't. So you can't judge what's going on, I don't think, unless you were there and had, you know, acute observation skills and you figure out what position to take. But there's nothing in the news that you can say you're knowledgeable about.
When I was at CKLN early on, and we went to some, you know, I think we were in Quebec City, and there were a lot of, you know, anarchists there, supposedly,
yeah,
hooded people or whatever, throwing bricks through windows and so on and agitating. I said to the person who was organizing, another anarchist, that was the person organizing our little trip up there, who was sort of in authority, you know, being paid, had a salary at the station. And I said to her, you know, I think some of these people, how do we know that these people are not from the state? And she took great umbrage with this, right? And years later, it was... it came out that they were a lot of this type of damage that was being done. It was indeed done by people who were working for the state, who were dressed up to look like anarchists and so on,
right,
had been sent in there to agitate and do things to make whatever was going on, you know, to demonize protesting.
You see, that's why you engage in public space, you're going to be stupid. You will lose in the end. I know who you're talking about at CKLN. They were naive, but they thought a public space was an important place. What people don't really understand deeply is how little the public space is existing anymore.
Well, not only that, I mean, the public space, like, for instance, City Hall in Toronto, Nathan Phillips Square, you're familiar with, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That is not a public space. When you go on there, you can be told to leave. A lot of areas, like universities and so on, they say, oh, will we welcome the public? But then again, it's not a public space. More and more of areas of the city are not, you're not available to be there.
Well, didn't they, but you have to get a permit to do a protest at City Hall then.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you can go there and, you know, but there's a certain point where they'll go, you can't do that. And
yeah,
then they'll come and, you know, it becomes unclear what you can do, what you can't do, but they know when the hammer's going to drop and you can be escorted out of a public area for doing something that, you know, you'd think
so
you
what
could
is,
do.
What is the public space at City Hall? If it's
nothing.
Not public.
Nothing. Really? Nothing. Technically,
yeah,
nothing. The public can go there, but it's not public space.
Did you say not public space? Yes.
It's not public space. For instance, the sidewalk outside of the convention center in Toronto is technically not public space.
Mm.
Well, so you can't. So that means that a protest can't occur on that sidewalk, on the side of the street of the Toronto Convention Center. The Canadian National Exhibition grounds are not public space. You cannot go on to the...
So
the
major public spaces are not public. Public spaces are little obscure parks and things. You could do something there.
Yes, I think you can do something in a park, yes.
Yeah,
you can do something in a park. But I'm sure they're going to try and stop that. And,
well, that's a good update of the no public space point. That's becoming a fact. In bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So look, let's play Zappa.
Okay.
Unless Reiner, you got anything to say, Reiner?
Nope. Zappa.
But what Craig's saying is what he has managed to regale us with is pretty interesting, eh, Reiner?
Well, sure. And
he doesn't have to say yes to that.
Well, no, I just think because the whole notion of public space is a delusional thing, because I know when I have my students wanting to do work outside of the grounds of the university, it's interesting how often they find out that where they thought was actually public is all private land with security and all that stuff, and they can't have access to it. And then even on university, our university is designed according to the
late 1960s, early 70s designs in California, where there are sight lines all the way through the campus so that no one can gather.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, I got to make sure our Skype is connected. So, Bill, can you check to see if we're connected? Because often that dies over these hours. So, reconnect my Skype or something. And so I'm waiting for that.
How's Bill doing out there?
I don't know. I don't know if Bill falls asleep or what.
It was nice to hear his voice again. It's comforting.
Yeah, Bert's listening.
Hi, Bert.
We'll get some input from Bert later. Okay, so, yeah, he quotes me. There goes your passport, Greg.
I was watching an episode of Danger Man with Patrick McGoo, and no one in the United States is secret agent in the 1960s. And they're running that every week on an American station that I get. And this guy in the story, this British official, had disappeared. Now, we, the audience, had seen what was going on, what he was up to. But Patrick McGoohan, playing John Drake, the secret agent, goes and interviews his wife, quite brutally, actually, and to try to get information out of her as to where her husband might be and whether she's involved. And at one point, he goes over to the library of books they have, and he starts reading out the titles. And he says, Agatha Christie, and she says, oh, I'm an Agatha Christie, fanatic, and so on. He says, oh, I don't see any Karl Marx here. And she goes, oh, my husband is, there's no question about his patriotism.
This is from a show from the 60s.
65, yeah.
And your point is what?
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that, in this show that I watched as a child, John Drake is going around looking at someone's library and then wondering whether, starting to make illusions about Karl Marx. it's undoubtedly a Cold War television program. It almost always deals with, anti-communism. But I was a little struck by that today, where he starts invoking Karl Marx, a German philosopher who lived in England in the 1860s, that, if you had a book there, well, that would really show that you were, going off to the other side, when the other side really hadn't even been created at that point.
When we make TV shows, it's going to be, you have no books by LaRouche here. That's going to be the modern bit more. But, did you know that Karl Marx wrote a column for the New York Tribune?
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah. I mean, he was a columnist, journalist.
He made money.
Yeah. Did he live in the States at any point?
I don't think so, though I think he did travel there.
Yeah, visit. But his column was written from Europe.
Yes, from London. I think he primarily lived in London.
Okay, so I've got to make sure. I've got the Bill hooked up to Skype. Now, I don't know if I have to, I can't remember if I have to change the audio.
Oh!
Whoa, that was neat.
Oh, that's good. That means it's connected. So, make sure the volume is up. Let's just see if it works right off.
Okay,
it's working.
I'm going to mute
everybody.
We don't get
environmental stuff. And so Zappa is being introduced. It's all blurry image, but hopefully the audio will be good enough. So I put this on mute.
I'm going to tell you, this is a very enthusiastic audience. and you'll feel warmly welcome the entire time. Could you describe for me what a documentary reporter is? I think I know, but perhaps our audience would like to know musical terms.
Well,
I can understand that.
Kind of by way of explaining the reason for what I do, you mean?
Well,
because of what I told the guy on the phone today?
Yeah, that's right. You told the guy on the phone that he called up and he said, Mr. Zappa, what do you do for a living? And he said, I am a documentary reporter. Which subject?
Well, it's like this. I see things happening, and I hear about things happening, and I respond to these things, and I write songs about them, and it's kind of like being a reporter, you know? But
yeah,
the things that I report on are topics that other people ignore or don't want to discuss.
Constantly? Always?
Well, I have written some songs about topics that other people have discussed in the past. I mean, I have written a couple of love songs,
mm-hmm.
but they're about certain love, but hey, you know, they don't want to put those aspects in television. Well, anyway, look. You know, a lot of people like to talk around the subject.
That's right.
You know, this is what we call the euphemistic circumlocution.
Exactly. That is what talk shows are for.
That's
euphemistic talk show.
Circumlocution.
Gosh, you got to learn to say it for these deals, that's right. How do you
circumlocute?
No. I think I know, but I'm not sure I want to hear it described. But how would you do a documentary accounting of the music of the 60s? Yes, could you generalize on that?
Well,
we have representatives of the people who... Okay.
Just check this out.
Okay.
Well, in order to talk about the 60s.
Okay.
Now, actually, there's not much reason to talk about the 60s unless you're nostalgic, and everybody's nostalgic, so let's talk about the 60s.
Yeah.
The 60s were a lot of fun for the policemen and the government, but there was marvelous work opportunities for people in those trades. And,
you're talking about one of our colors.
That's okay, I'm telling you.
I didn't know. I didn't become a policeman until 1970.
Oh, okay. You're exactly.
Okay, so you got on the tail end of a good business. Well, it depends. It really depends. You know, some of them like the neck bone. You might like the tailbone, but listen, I don't know.
Can I get the music in the 60s?
Yes, music.
The music in the 60s made a statement, a very definite statement.
Yes, it did. It told the world that after the 50s, that things other than songs just about love
right.
could be manufactured and sold for enormous right. profit to the American people.
What's wrong with that? It brought...
That's right. Anything. Surfboards.
Surfboards and skateboards. But in...
going this direction, it did arouse the social consciousness of a lot of people. I would say Bob Dylan contributed a great deal in that era, and Simon and Garfunkel, in some of the statements that a lot of those people made in the 60s were significant without bearing down.
Well, I don't believe in a social conscience. I don't believe people have a social conscience.
You don't?
No. I believe that the American public likes to have a good time and doesn't have much of a conscience at all. And I think that, and if this wasn't true, then hey, we got disco music to prove it. Now look, the whole idea is to have a good time, right?
So always.
I think if you find an American who says he doesn't want to have a good time, he's a communist.
We all want to feel good, and we all want to feel joy, and we all want to feel love. So then how does that, how is that compatible with the kind of criticism that you're talking about? The cynicism that I'm talking about is my own personal opinion, you know, I'm the kind of person that tells you my opinion. Yeah. Now the thing about opinions is, if you agree with me, then you'll agree with me, and if you don't agree with me, I'll never convince you, but I think I have a very cynical attitude towards the American public's conscience, because if they had one, a lot of the bad stuff that is happening wouldn't happen. So, you know, we don't have a conscience.
but we do like to have a good time.
Well, don't you think that the fact that we're discussing it means that there are some of us who have a conscience about some of the things that are happening in the American scene?
Well, if there was somebody watching this who had a conscience, their conscience would probably bother them, and they would go get a sandwich. But the rest of them would watch this and say, we're having a good time, you know?
We're having a good time.
Yeah, you're having a good time.
No.
I'm sick, and I know you're sick, too. So.
I don't think it's a question of conscience. I mean, as a matter of fact, I don't even want to get into